I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. 2,000 former Justice Department employees have called in an open letter for Attorney General William Barr to resign. They criticized how he overruled the 7 to 9 year sentence federal prosecutors in his department recommended for Roger Stone. The longtime ally of President Trump had been found guilty of obstruction, threatening a witness, and lying to Congress. Barr and other department leaders recommended a lesser sentence for Stone, which elicited a tweet from Trump, praising Barr for, quote, taking control of the case. The four attorneys resigned from the case last week, and one resigned from his job. The judge, Amy Berman Jackson, is set to rule on Stone's sentence this Thursday. Coming up, Attorney General Barr's relationship with the president, judicial independence, and the rule of law. But first, the latest on this ongoing story with Katie Benner, who covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. And Katie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Yesterday it was 1,000, and as of today, it's 2,000 former Justice Department employees who have called for the Attorney General of the United States to resign. How unprecedented is this?
So this is an incredibly unusual move. We have to remember, of course, the strongly worded letter. I very highly doubt that Attorney General Barr is going to resign because of it, because of 2,000 former discontented employees. But what you have to remember is that Justice Department attorneys by nature are rather conservative, and I just mean like sort of buttoned up. I'm not talking about politics. I think they're just a very conservative, buttoned up crowd. They don't usually criticize the department or its leadership. The public rebuke is very striking. Also, the number of people who've signed on is very striking. This, after the Mueller report came out, hundreds of former DOJ alums signed a letter saying they felt that the Mueller report made a strong case for actually charging President Trump with obstruction of justice. But that was only a few hundred signatories. This is many, many, many more. So again, it's not only an unusual move, I think that it mirrors concern, if not discontent, that is also playing out inside of the Justice Department as people try to figure out just how politicized has this place become under Trump and how much power does the president have over our decisions.
Quoting from the letter, they quote from the DOJ rule book, the rule of law depends on the even-handed administration of justice. What is the complaint coming from these former justice officials?
Yeah, so they're saying basically the Stone case shows that rather than allow the wheels of justice to turn for the department to make a sentencing recommendation and for then the judge to decide whether or not, you know, that sentencing recommendation is what she is going to stick with, which is normal process, that the president reached in and changed the recommendation and then went onto Twitter and tried to bully the judge who makes the final decision into granting leniency for Roger Stone, the president's long, long, long-time friend. So that is not the even application of the rule of law. If the president can step in and push the Justice Department through its officials to change a recommendation, if the president can then go into a public forum and bully the judge who makes the ultimate determination to try to intimidate her to, again, lower the sentencing, that is no longer the even application of justice. That is what this letter is saying.
What do we need to know about this judge, Amy Berman Jackson? As I said in my introduction, she's set to rule on this Stone sentence this Thursday, although she called for a meeting today.
Yes. So first, Judge Amy Berman Jackson has a fantastic reputation. She's known to be extremely fair and extremely tough. She does not allow a lot of shenanigans in her court. She does not like it when people do not respond promptly. And honestly, she has reprimanded Roger Stone in the past for doing things like, making statements during his trial that were interfering with the trial, for sort of making veiled threats and for making other improper comments. She likes decorum. I don't think anybody thinks she's going to be threatened by what the president has said on Twitter. The problem, though, and this goes again to what we think of as a working criminal justice system, the problem is that now the president has publicly threatened her and tried to push for an outcome in this case, it really impairs the ability for her to do her job. So if she does decide that Roger Stone, the sentencing guidelines technically say 7 to 9 years, but he has no priors, mm-hmm. He's older, you can look at those factors and reasonably say, you know what, 7 to 9 is really high. If she gives them anything but 7 to 9, it's going to look, the appearance will be that she was successfully bullied by President Trump. And as we've seen in the past, that is certainly how the president would be inclined to interpret it and spin it to his supporters, right? So that's not great. And if she does the 7 to 9 or goes higher, it will look like she's then defying the president, which is, again, how it could be spun to his voters online. So she is in somewhat of a damned if you do, damned if you don't position. And the reason why this is a problem, again, and the reason why these former DOJ alums have written this letter, the reason why people inside of the department are concerned, is because in so many ways, this is what we think of as fair criminal justice is a confidence game. We have to have confidence that people are doing the right thing and that they're acting within the law and that they're using their best judgment. And if we think that that's not true, if we start to believe at the margins that it's actually a political game, the system starts to fray.
Barr et al. Said that Stone deserved a lesser sentence. They remarked about his age. He's in his, I believe, mid-60s, something like 67. Also that the threat that he made was not taken seriously. How is that sort of factored in, do you think, to what the four prosecutors did when they quit the case and one quit his job?
You know, first of all, it's not in, like this idea of factoring in something like his age. That is not unusual, right? These things happen, and the judge is allowed to do all of that. It's just, I think what people are more concerned about is not the actual recommendation. It's not the idea that the Justice Department could have given a lower recommendation or even no recommendation. It just said, Judge, we leave it to your discretion, which is what the department ultimately did. Ultimately, the department basically in its second recommendation said, this is why why the guidelines say 7 to 9, but Judge, we think it should be less, but we leave it up to you. That sort of thing happens often. I think what people are taking issue with and the reason why the four prosecutors withdrew from the case is not because of the ultimate recommendation, but how it was come to. They did not make this their initial recommendation. They couldn't come to this decision behind closed doors as is normally done. And the appearance of politics because of the president's public statements so colored the case that they just couldn't be part of it anymore.
Let me play a clip from Attorney General William Barr. And this is from an interview on ABC News last Thursday, and it made a lot of news itself. Let's give it a listen.
I am responsible for everything that happens in the department, but the thing I have most responsibility for are the issues that are brought to me for decision. And I will make those decisions based on what I think is the right thing to do, and I'm not going to be bullied or influenced by anybody. And I said at the time, whether it's Congress, newspaper, editorial boards, or the president, I'm going to do what I think is right. And, I cannot do my job here at the department with a constant background commentary that undercuts me.
Can the attorney general do his job under these circumstances?
I mean, the short answer is no, he absolutely can't. You know, if we go back in time and look at what happened with the Mueller investigation, the president was constantly tweeting about it, making public remarks about it, saying that, you know, these prosecutors on the Mueller team were crooked. They were angry Democrats. He was constantly undercutting the credibility of their work. Interestingly, though, the Mueller team, the special counsel's team, while it did technically report to the attorney general as part of the Justice Department, it was really thought of almost as an ancillary department, something kind of a little bit outside of the normal course of business for DOJ. And so it did create this buffer between the president and the Justice Department specifically. That is gone. And so now all these attacks, they are directly on the department. They are directly on the attorney general himself, even if not specifically aimed at him, aimed at his people, aimed at the work of the department. And you cannot be credible as the attorney general. You cannot have a credible Justice Department if the president is constantly trying to make it look like the AG is your lackey, which is what he did immediately following the decision to redo the sentencing recommendation. He came out on Twitter. He said, thank you, Attorney General Bill Barr, for doing what I wanted you to do. He went on Geraldo Rivera and basically said essentially the same thing, like, thank goodness that the AG is my man and he's going to do what I say. that does not give Bill Barr any credibility. It does undercut him, and it does make it very hard for anybody to look at him and say, this is a person who believes in the even-handed application of justice.
The Attorney General has also created a quote-unquote intake process for Rudy Giuliani to send information about Ukraine, reviewing the Mike Flynn case. I mean, it seems as if the Attorney General wants to investigate the investigators.
Yes, and it's interesting. The Attorney General is allowing a lot of moves to be made that you would think that President Trump would like. He's also making some moves that Trump wouldn't like, you know, deciding not to charge Andy McCabe with a crime for false statements to the FBI. He's going to do both. And what I think he's trying to say is, if you continue to undercut me and make these statements, the times I do things for you that you will like, nobody will believe them, and they will have no veracity or credibility, and you don't want that either. But it's true. Bill Barr believes that presidents should have a huge amount of power. He believes in a very strong executive at the top of the executive branch, I guess, for lack of a better term. So philosophically, he is actually in line with some of President Trump's more authoritarian instincts, and that is okay. He's just saying, I have been really great. I'm doing my job. Please do not interfere. Whether or not the president ultimately decides to listen, I think we will see in the following weeks.
What was the message from the 2,000 former prosecutors to the current prosecutors now working at the Department of Justice?
Well, this is sort of an interesting thing, and we haven't really seen this so much before. We've seen it again, and in we've definitely seen people saying to government employees, do your jobs, keep your chins up, and, you know, follow the rules. But what they're saying, go a step beyond that. Be a whistleblower. If you see something wrong, if you see a misapplication of justice, if you see political interference, by all means, please speak out about it. That is interesting. They are basically calling for employees within to take the normal course of business and take their responsibilities as government employees and to also be willing and able to resist and to become whistleblowers. Now, that is a little bit more extreme. And again, these are extreme times.
Right. Katie, we're almost out of time here. Then what is the mood in the Justice Department, especially among line producers? Excuse me, line prosecutors.
Oh, you know, it is last week, I think morale hit a low that we probably haven't seen in quite a while. We haven't seen probably since, you know, Jeff Sessions was constantly under fire. It was interesting, too, because keep in mind that for prosecutors, for people who work in the criminal division, the National Security Division, the U.S. Attorney's Office is prosecuting cases like gun cases and human trafficking cases and drug cases. Usually the politics of D.C. do not affect them, right? The politics, that is the civil rights division, the civil division, the folks who have to argue on behalf of the government's policies. Those folks always get kind of caught up in the buzzsaw of politics in any administration, Republican or Democrat. But the prosecutors are usually shielded. It was interesting to see this group of people exposed to it. They did not like it. And again, the morale really dropped.
Well, Katie Benner, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. We are talking about what is happening at the Justice Department. We've got two law professors waiting in the wings. Do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscow, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me recap. Last year, Roger Stone, longtime ally of President Trump, was convicted by a jury of obstructing justice, lying to Congress, and threatening a witness. Federal prosecutors called for a 7 to 9 year prison sentence, which is reportedly within the federal guidelines. Last Tuesday, Trump tweeted in the middle of the night, "Cannot allow this miscarriage of justice." That same day, the Justice Department overruled the prosecutors calling for less time. Shortly after that, all four prosecutors quit the Stone case and one quit his job in protest. On Wednesday, Trump tweeted congratulations to Attorney General William Barr for taking control of the case, also saying the prosecutor should apologize to Stone for treating him so badly. Trump said he has the legal right to do anything in a criminal case, even if he chose not to. He also criticized the judge in the Stone case and accused the jury forewoman of bias. Now, 2,000 former Justice Department officials have called for Barr to resign. All of this raises some some serious and troubling questions about the independence of the Justice Department, the relationship between the Attorney General and the President, Trump's expansive view of his own authority, and the rule of law. We have two law professors who join us on Radio Times. Katie Roiffe joining us by Skype. She's a professor of law at New York Law School, who studies lawyers' ethics and prosecutorial independence, particularly with regard to the president's power to control the Department of Justice. And Rebecca Roiffe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Lauren Uziel. She's Associate Professor of Law at Temple University, a former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York and Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And she is one of the 2,000 former Justice Department officials who signed this letter calling for William Barr to resign. And Lauren Uziel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me start with you. Why do you think the Attorney General should resign his job?
Because I think he's lost the confidence of a community of Justice Department officials, current and former, to administer fair and impartial justice. And, you know, the Justice Department only has, I mean, Katie Benner put it very well, right? It operates on trust. It's a system of trust. It's a system of credibility. And when trust is lost and credibility is lost, it makes it impossible for prosecutors to do their job. And I think that what's happened here is that the Attorney General has not defended the independence of the Justice Department in the ways he is needed to do to ensure that there's continued trust.
Let me just do a quick follow-up, and then, Rebecca, we'll get you in on the conversation. But how unprecedented was it for the Attorney General and his associates essentially to overrule or undercut the sentence coming from the four prosecutors?
Absolutely unprecedented. I mean, unprecedented on several levels. So, just to take a step back, it's rare for an attorney general, right, who's leading a department of thousands of people to get involved in sentencing decisions in individual cases. It happens, but that in and of itself is rare. But then you add on top of that, getting involved in a case that has implications for the president's personal and political interests, that's a real breach of norms. And then on top of that, the decision to overrule line prosecutors who had already made a representation to the court in a submission, and to say, Judge, what the Department of Justice said yesterday is not what the Department of Justice is saying today, that's an incredible breach. It's really an abuse, and it undercuts the fact that the Department of Justice speaks for the United States and should speak in one voice.
Rebecca, let me get you in on the conversation. And President Trump has said in no uncertain terms that he wants his Roy Cohn to run the Justice Department. Does he have his Roy Cohn in William Barr?
You know, I don't think that William Barr, I believed him when he spoke on ABC, and Katie Benner put it well that, you know, he's feeling under fire. He feels like he's not able to do what he wants to do. That said, I think he is not. I agree with Lauren that he is not doing his job of protecting the independence of the Department of Justice. I think that he probably buys into this idea of the deep state and, you know, absurdly that the Department of Justice is a part of the deep state because, as Katie was saying, this is a group of people who are buttoned up and conservative, not conservative politically necessarily, but these are not people who are after the president politically. They never have been. And so this particular view of the Department of Justice itself is corrosive. And if he thinks that there is corruption within the Department of Justice, he is not going about it the proper way. There are proper avenues, if you believe that there are people who are not doing their job well within this department, to make sure that that is fixed. Instead, he has taken the reins in an unprecedented way. And that's problematic because he is a political actor. The line prosecutors are by nature and by definition not political actors, and they are trained to do justice in individual cases. And so they are the ones who traditionally have the role in these individual decisions, not somebody who's connected, so deeply connected with political actors.
Well, it seems like all eyes will be on the judge later this week about what she rules. And Katie was talking about she's also caught, Lauren, between these various forces at play in the Justice Department.
Yeah, and I think it's really unfortunate, frankly, as well for the defendant in this case, because you know, the defendant deserves a fair and impartial system as well. And when you have this kind of pressure put on a sentencing where the public now is going to take from the sentence that's imposed some sort of message about whether the judge, right, as Katie said, is standing up to the president or whether she's not. And that's really not what a sentence is about or should be about. It really should be about the judge taking into account all the factors and circumstances about this particular individual defendant, the conduct he did and the surrounding circumstances, and imposing a fair and reasonable sentence.
What do you think, Rebecca? How do you see the pressure on this particular judge?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think these norms, you know, you say like this is just the way people act, but it's not etiquette. These norms serve a purpose. They are, in fact, what makes the justice system work. So they've been broken now on several levels. First, the president himself tweeting so repeatedly and so explicitly about the result that he thinks is right in this individual case. And then you have the attorney general taking control in a way that attorneys general don't. Mm-hmm. And once those norms are broken, we don't have the system that we had before. It's not reliable. And so the whatever result, people are going to look at it and think one thing or another, but they certainly it's certainly going to be hard, even though I think that the judge is really going to do her job as best she can under this pressure. It's really going to be hard to look at that and say, yeah, that's just what Roger Stone deserves. The judge is being fair.
Well, you know, Lauren and I were talking about this before going on the air, which is in many ways what guides the Justice Department are norms, especially in its relationship with whoever happens to be the president of the United States. And previous presidents have sort of operated under these norms. We have a president today who does not want to do that and does not do that. So if norms, I'm looking at you, Lauren, but if norms kind of define how the Justice Department is supposed to work and you've got a president who doesn't want to abide by those norms, what do you do? Who intervenes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it falls to the heads of these executive branch departments to defend the independence of their departments from political meddling. And that's why what has happened here is so deeply concerning because, you know, I mean, look, if you compare how, you know, we've had this president for a number of years. He's who he is. He's going to be who he's going to be.
He's not going to stop tweeting.
He's not going to stop tweeting. He's not going to stop trying to interfere. It falls on the leaders of these departments to defend their independence. And, you know, Attorney General Sessions did that. And, you know,
when he recused himself,
when
right?
he recused himself. And you see a very marked change in right with Attorney General Barr. And as a result, less confidence in the independence of the Justice Department.
He, though, has talked about his view of executive power, which is, you know, pretty expansive. He, even before the Mueller report went public, he really misrepresented what Mueller said here. So there is a track. Again, I'm looking at you, Lauren, but there is a track record for this attorney general. And then, Rebecca, we'll get you back in on the conversation. But just, you know, how are we supposed to interpret that?
Yeah, I think that's also what's happened here is that this doesn't, right, this incident doesn't come in a vacuum. It's part of a larger pattern that we see here of an attorney general that seems to be intervening in ways that pretty consistently benefit the president's personal and political interests. And that's what's so deeply concerning.
Rebecca, is there a role for the Supreme Court or for Congress to, if not intervene, at least to respond?
You know, I mean, I argued in this Law Review article that I wrote that, you know, actually intervening in individual prosecutions, if that's what actually happened, and Bill Barr said now on ABC that it's not, but if that's what actually happened, that does in fact go against what Congress has said, at least implicitly, in creating the Department of Justice. I think that's a hard case to make. I think it'll be a hard case to win. As much as I argued it, I don't think that there's really legal recourse here. I think, you know, our system as a whole, I mean, this is very, you know, it's sort of troubling, but our system as a whole is really dependent on the character and integrity of the people who operate within it and run it. And so, you know, when you have somebody who's willing to defy these kinds of norms, and then, you know, you've had these institutions that you've seen hold up so well under that pressure, but again, I agree with Lauren. If you have people in charge of those institutions who aren't doing what it takes to stand up to that pressure, then we really are in trouble. And I'm not exactly sure how Congress can step in. I mean, they can step in to get at the truth, which I think they're going to do on March 31st when they when they have Barr come in. But other than transparency, I'm not particularly hopeful. I think, you know, it's a matter of looking at what we've got and hopefully having an electorate that actually cares and makes sure that we put in place, you know, something that looks a little bit different, especially in terms of law enforcement and the Justice Department.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Rebecca Roife joining us by Skype. She's a professor of law at New York University Law School. Lauren Oziel with us here in our Philadelphia studios, associate professor of law at Temple University, former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York and the Eastern District of PA, and she's one of the 2,000 former prosecutors who has called for Attorney General William Barr to resign from office. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Lauren and Rebecca, I'm thinking about the institutions and even thinking about Watergate when the institutions did hold and a president was, in a sense, forced to leave the White House. But I'm also thinking about Colonel Vindman, who lost his job at the White House. The president called for some kind of punishment for him. And I thought it was interesting, Lauren, that the U.S. Army said no. We are not going to punish Colonel Vindman. He answered a subpoena. He did nothing wrong. You know, we're going to move ahead. How significant is that?
I mean, I would hope that that's just the norm, right? That's what you want the system to do. That's how you want it to work. That's how it should work. And ideally, we wouldn't be surprised by that. And the fact that we are, that we even note that and find it interesting that the Army is standing behind a lieutenant colonel who responded to a validly issued subpoena, right? That we think that that is somehow special or significant in some way, when that's really how the system should run, is in and of itself concerning. That is somehow unusual, and I think part of it is because we look now, we see that, and we compare it to what's happening in the Justice Department, and we don't see that sort of independence coming out of the Justice Department.
Rebecca, how do you interpret that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Trump supporters think to themselves, you know, this is just the president. This is his way. He doesn't really mean it. He tweets this or he tweets that, and we mostly ignore it. And I think increasingly, what's become clear is that his words have an effect, regardless of whether or not he has the power or will actually push through and do what he wants to do. So if you take the case with the Stone sentencing, he says that. Barr, let's just take him at his word. Assume that Barr was going to do this anyway, didn't care what the president was saying, you know, which I think is inappropriate anyway, but say he was going to do that. It doesn't matter, because now that the president has come out and said that, that's a message. It's a message to line prosecutors. It's a message to the Department of Justice. It's a message to anybody who wants to hold anybody near or dear to him accountable for anything. And the same thing with Vindman, because even if the military is standing up for him, which is, you know, it is a sign of institutions working, it's not impervious to this that people within those institutions are going to listen, which is, if I come forward and if I see something and say what I saw in accord with whistleblowing laws, I can't do that quietly. I can't do that and continue my job. There will be retribution in the form of tweets, and that in and of itself sends a strong message. That is a deterrent, and that's concerning.
A comment from Melba: Barr sees his job as protecting the president, not working for the country. There's also a question that has come in. Has the American Bar Association taken any position on this? I mean, as of this morning, I haven't seen anything. Have you, Lauren?
I have not. I did see that the New York City Bar did take a position on it and request. They wrote a letter to the Inspector General of the Department of Justice asking for an investigation into this and as well to the relevant congressional committees.
Rebecca, I also saw that a National Association of Federal Judges has called for an emergency meeting actually today to address some of their growing concerns about what's been happening at the Justice Department. In fact, the Philadelphia U.S. District Judge Cynthia Roof was quoted in USA Today. What do you make of that?
So, you know, again, I think that you are seeing that's unprecedented. I mean, and it's certainly significant in the same way that the letter from the now 2000 former employees of the Justice Department is significant. I think the reticence you might see on the part of an organization like the American Bar Association is, look, like all of these institutions, we rely on all of these institutions to be neutral. And now taking any position makes it seem as if one's not, even if it is a perfectly neutral position and a perfectly reasonable position to take, even if you're just defending the rule of law. So I think some of the reluctance comes from a fear that everything, that the success of the president will be to politicize everything. We won't have any institutions left where we can say, look, when they come out with something, when this institution says something, that is just a neutral reflection of their expertise rather than a particular partisan point of view. And I think there's some concern. When do we come out and say something as an organization, and when risking in some way that we will be cast as political actors, and when do we preserve our own neutrality by staying out if we can? And that, you know, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I'm sitting here shaking my head on the radio because, and we're almost up on a break here, Lauren, but I mean, we have a president who we know how he's going to respond going forward. He will continue to criticize Judge Curiel. He's now criticizing this judge that's going to rule on the Stone case. We know that this is what's going to happen going forward.
Yeah, I mean, this is, look, no institution is immune at this point. No institution is immune. And so when you have this sort of, you know, sort of incessant attacks on the independence and integrity of institutions that Americans have long taken for granted as institutions they can rely on as apolitical, then you have a real threat.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Lauren Oziel and Rebecca Roife. We are talking about a whole host of things related to the Justice Department and the fact that some 2,000 of former prosecutors, including one of our guests, have called for Attorney General William Barr to resign. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about what's happening at the Justice Department. Last week, four prosecutors who had recommended a 7 to 9 year sentence for President Trump's ally Roger Stone quit the case. One actually quit his job after their decision was overridden by their boss, Attorney General William Barr. And some 2,000 former Justice Department officials have called for Barr to resign. We're talking about all of this with Rebecca Roife and Lauren Oziel, some of the constitutional issues at stake when it comes to judicial independence and the rule of law. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Lauren, you wanted to go back to something that actually I was talking with Katie Benner from the New York Times about related to these guidelines, but it's an important point. Yeah. I want to make sure we don't miss it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out just because I think there's been a lot of information and misinformation circulating about it. So here's a key thing to understand. The guidelines in this case are set by the U.S. Sentencing Commission.
And these are the sentencing guidelines.
These are the sentencing guidelines, and they apply in every case. And the whole goal of the sentencing guidelines is to have some mode of uniformity, some baseline from which the parties and the judge can argue. The parties can argue about the sentence. The judge can think about what sentence would be reasonable. It's important to understand the government's revised sentencing submission that was submitted after the president's tweet, that did not disagree with the calculation of the guidelines. Okay, so it was not taking a position that the guidelines were improperly calculated. In addition, the probation department, which is an independent arm of the judicial branch, had also calculated the guidelines in that way. And so everyone agrees, with the exception of the defense, who's arguing that the guidelines shouldn't be calculated in this way. But the government's submissions were consistent with the probation department that the proper guidelines range is 87 to 108 months. That is 7 to 9 years.
Right.
And so what the government submission, revised submission, is asking for is to the court to consider a sentence below the guidelines range. And it's important for people to understand, I think, quite how unusual that is in and of itself in a case in which a defendant has gone to trial. So Katie Benner, who was talking about it, she's correct that it is not unusual that the government would sort of signal to the court that it wouldn't object to a sentence below the guidelines range or would even ask for one in a case where the conviction resulted from a plea agreement. But in a case where a defendant has gone to trial, it is really highly unusual. And I actually went back and looked at the data on this in the most recent annual sentencing data. And the government has advocated for below guidelines range sentences in cases that resolve without a plea agreement in less than 2% of cases.
Oh, wow. So it really is unusual.
Yeah, it's unusual. And in asking for a guideline sentence in this case, the prosecutors were really just playing it by the book.
Hmm. Let me go back to you, Rebecca Roifey, because what has also happened while we've been spending most of our time talking about the Roger Stone case, other things are happening at the Justice Department. Barr is now investigating the Flynn case, he who had already pled guilty. He has opened up the door for Rudy Giuliani to talk to, I believe it's a U.S. attorney in Pittsburgh, about what he has been finding in Ukraine. And we know that a lot of that is related to conspiracy theories. But what do you make of what Barr is doing sort of outside of the Justice Department in D.C.?
Right. I mean, so one thing I want to add to what Lauren just said is that, you know, there are ways it is perfectly fine and acceptable. And what we want an attorney general to do, to make broad policy recommendations that affect all cases. So if the attorney general had said, you know, I think we should be more lenient in this type of case, and then it was broadly applied to all cases, that would be fine. What's problematic is him jumping into one particular case, problematic and unprecedented. So I just wanted to add that to right. what Lauren had just said. In terms of the other things, look, there are two things that we don't want a leader, a president to do. One of them is to use the Justice Department to go after his enemies. And we don't want him to use the Justice Department in order to be lenient or forgiving for his friends. And I think the problem is it sure looks like he's doing both when we look at all of this, because it looks like the Roger Stone and the Flynn case look very much like, hey, those are my buddies, lay off, you know, he's using the Justice Department to protect his friends. And then with this direct line to the U.S. attorneys for Giuliani, it now looks like the flip side, which is you now are going to have special access that most normal citizens don't have. I mean, if I want to go after somebody, I can't just bring a whole, you know, pile and boxes of evidence to a U.S. attorney's office. So it's like there's a direct line. And that looks like, why is the Department of Justice being used now as a way in which to investigate an enemy? Now, again, it's not the way prosecutors normally do things. We also don't go after individuals. We go after, we try to solve crimes. We pursue evidence in order to figure out crimes, not, I think, very importantly, going after individuals. And that's another thing that it looks like. It begins to look like there's this, you know, let's get Hunter Biden, let's get Joe Biden. And that's not the way the Justice Department is supposed to work or has worked in the past, and looks very troubling again, going back to the theme of this whole conversation, which is how do we have confidence that what the Justice Department is doing is what it's always done, which is administer justice in an even-handed way.
Let me quote something from an interview that the president did with Geraldo Rivera. This was from last week. Geraldo Rivera asked, was it strange to send Rudy Giuliani to Ukraine, your personal lawyer? Are you sorry you did that? President Trump, not at all. Rudy was a great crime fighter, and you know that may be better than anyone. Geraldo Rivera, of course, yeah. It should be said, though, that the president had previously denied that he sent Rudy Giuliani to Ukraine. So going back to you, Lauren, is the president in trouble? Could he be re-impeached based on things that he is now saying after his acquittal?
Could he be? Yes. Will he be? You know, it seems unlikely. I mean, that's really up to the political branches. And that's a decision for Congress.
Right. Right. I mean, it's to stay outside of that particular particular issue. That's a congressional issue.
Yeah.
And whether to do that or not. A number of presidential candidates were asked, you know, if you become president, would you go after Trump or maybe even Barr? Some of them said yes. Some of them said no. But is that a good question?
No. I mean, well, it's a question. I think the answer should be, for the same reason that I think the answer, you know, here should be, a president should not make a decision in an individual case and weigh into that. And so, no, I think it's completely inappropriate for, you know, presidential candidates to announce in advance, you know, I'm going to order my Justice Department to investigate Barr or Trump or anyone else individually. I mean, again, it's very important. It's critical for the rule of law and for the public's trust in the Justice Department that decisions about prosecutions in individual cases are made apart from politics. Mm.
I think what complicates it, too, Rebecca, is that the president, a president, gets to pick their attorney general. And then once they're confirmed, they're supposed to be independent from each other. And President Trump has said, you know, look at Robert Kennedy and John F. Kennedy. Look at President Obama's attorney general, Eric Holder, saying, you know, I want something like that. Can you speak to that?
Yes, I actually think at this point we understand that attorney generals are part political actors and part legal actors. So in a certain way, I'm not surprised that Barr would be protecting President Trump on some level. I think that's okay. And I think that's done. And there is precedent for that. I think what's problematic is that he has a double role, and his double role is to protect the rest of the department, the part of the department that has the obligation to enforce these laws in a fair way from that political influence. So he can be, he's a cabinet member. Of course, he has some political connection, but he has an obligation to serve as a filter to prevent those political partisan considerations from affecting the work that the Department of Justice prosecutors do. And Katie made this distinction. Sure, civil rights, there's some other divisions where it's fine. But for prosecutors who are enforcing the law, they should not be taking into account political considerations, and it should not seem as if they are taking into account political considerations. And so part of Barr's job is to make sure that that's the case. If he feels that in some way it has not worked that way, then we have the Inspector General, we have the Department of Professional Responsibility. Those are the mechanisms to root out any kind of corruption.
That's exactly right. And precisely because he is a political actor and a member of the cabinet and reports directly to the president that he should not be getting involved in these individual cases. And it's precisely why, I mean, you know, just to take a step back, all of these cases arose, they were spinoffs from the special counsel's office.
From Mueller.
For Mueller. And the reason we had Mueller to begin with was because we needed, as I believe as Becky said, or Katie, I can't remember, we needed an additional buffer beyond what we already normally have in the Justice Department to protect an investigation that came so close to the president. And so for the attorney general to get involved in those cases in particular is just right. That's really outside the norm.
But what about the president? He tweeted that he has a legal right to do anything in a criminal case, even if he chooses not to get involved. Is he on firm ground there?
Go ahead, Becky.
Go ahead, Rebecca. And then we'll get Lauren, and then I got some comments. Yeah, go ahead.
No matter what your view of this, you know, there's this view that Barr takes that there's a unitary executive and the president has the ability to control everything that goes on with law enforcement. I don't personally agree with that or read the law that way. But even if you do, the president has an obligation to take care. This is a constitutional obligation to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Faithful execution of the laws involves this separation between political partisan considerations and the application or enforcement of the law. So by getting involved, he is directly undermining that constitutional requirement. And that is problematic no matter what you see how you view the executive.
Let me toss some, Lauren, I'm going to get a response from you. Stephanie Grisham, who's the White House press secretary, said the president is a private citizen with free speech rights just like any other citizen. Can you speak to all this?
The president is, he has the power and control over the United States government. And when it comes to the Justice Department, right, that's a power over law enforcement. I mean, let's be clear, the power to invoke or withhold the penal sanction is an awesome power.
Absolutely.
Right? And so to the extent that we allow a person who has personal and political interests in the outcome of a criminal investigation to get involved and influence the course of that investigation, we're essentially allowing that person to rig the system to his or her benefit. And that's exactly what the threat is. And that is, right, this is the playbook of autocrats. It's, right, that's step one. You take the power to invoke or withhold the penal sanction and you leverage it to your benefit. And by doing that, you can avoid accountability, political accountability, and ensure your continued power. And that's why this norm of Justice Department independence is so critical to a democracy.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Joan. No one seems to have any answers as to what recourse we have to an ongoing march to authoritarianism. What if Trump loses but refuses to leave office? What do you think about that, Rebecca?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to add to the First Amendment point. The First Amendment is a right as against the government. Right. The First Amendment says that the government can't enact any law or do anything to abridge the First Amendment rights of the people. The president here is acting as the president. So this particular argument to me is a little incoherent on that view. You know, I think that this particular administration and this particular way, it is just highlighted again, as I said in the beginning, that our institutions and our democracy relies on the character and integrity of the people who run it, and that is the public has to be educated in these things and figure out who do we want to have in these positions.
Here's a tweet. How can Attorney General Barr act surprised that Trump is interfering with his role when Trump did it for 2 years blatantly to Sessions? Barr knew this and still volunteered for the AG position. Do you have any thoughts about that, Lauren?
I don't think that he is surprised. You know, and frankly, I don't know. I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt on what he said on the ABC News interview. But, you know, given the pattern, it's hard to do that. It's hard to know that he actually, feels surprised or distressed by this, as opposed to sort of expressing a general distress with the fact that this is interfering with his ability to essentially get involved in ways that protect the president.
Yeah, I mean, I
go
I
ahead, think, Rebecca. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say that he promised at his confirmation hearings to keep politics out of the Department of Justice and to protect its integrity and independence. He did that knowing the president that he was going to work for. So I do think that interview sounded a little disingenuous. I mean, this is not a surprise. And therefore, and I think his job is harder. His job is harder because of who the president was that he was serving. But I think he had a responsibility to either curb the president's tweets. And if that's not possible, then he had to protect the department given those tweets. And he hasn't done that. He's failed, and that's on him.
Let me quote Laura Ingraham on Fox, who said, and I'll put this to you, Lauren, Barr is basically telling Trump, don't worry, I got this.
That is the concern that people have, that he's essentially saying, right? I mean, if you really parse what he said in that interview, it was, he's making it impossible for me to do my job. Well, you know, the question then is, what does he see at as his job? Right. That's the real question. And that's the one that everyone's so concerned about. And what it appears based on his practices in the office and also based on sort of his, you know, his writings, his speeches about his views of executive power, he sees his job as essentially holding the executive branch above reproach and above accountability, holding the president above accountability. And that's problematic.
And that's where we have to leave our conversation. My thanks to both of you. Lauren Oziel, thanks for coming in. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Martin.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of Law, Temple University, Rebecca Roife, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And she's a professor of law at New York University Law School. And we began our conversation with Katie Benner, Justice Department reporter for The New York Times. We appreciate all those comments to our program. You can carry on the conversation on our Facebook page. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.